This is the BBC World Service, and you're listening to Women on the Frontline with me, Emma Barnett.
The first initial fire that I received, I had checked myself to make sure I wasn't hit, and then I was like, okay, I can do this, I'm fine, and I returned fire. But I think everybody has that initial thought that, is this going to happen? Am I going to be able to perform? Am I going to be able to do my job? Because you never know until it actually happens, right?
And when you returned fire for the first time in Afghanistan, was that the first time you'd ever returned fire?
Yes, yeah.
And what did it feel like?
It felt natural. It felt like I was supposed to be doing this. I was, you know, because at that moment, it's you against them, right? They're firing at you, so there's no real hesitation about what you're doing.
I wasn't sure what to expect of a woman who's trained, fought, and lived her life shoulder to shoulder with men on the military front line, including tours in Kosovo, Bosnia, and Afghanistan. But Sergeant Brenda Hawke, a 16-year combat veteran in the Canadian infantry, came across as just a regular young woman doing her job, even if that does sometimes involve giving the new recruits a very rough time indeed.
But you go for it, like.
We all actually go for it, right? So
you're screaming at a bunch of young men.
Yes, and it's easy to do because they frustrate you. Ultimately, you want your students to succeed, and when they're not doing what they've been told or they're not performing the way you want them to, you get frustrated and you yell at them.
And there's plenty of yelling, believe me. One sergeant asked me if I wanted to see the recruits cry. And that slapping is the sound of 50 young men at the Canadian Army's Meaford training base, just north of Toronto, repeatedly throwing themselves onto floor mats.
BBC News with Neil Nunes. The Pentagon has confirmed that the American Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, is to end its ban on women in the military serving in combat roles.
When earlier this year the United States announced that women would be allowed to serve on the combat front line, it put the issue on the international agenda. But they are far from the first country to allow it. And in this BBC programme, I'll be exploring, with the help of women who've served in the infantry in Canada and South Africa, what it means to be a woman serving on the military front line. As more and more armies allow women to make these choices, I'll be examining what it says about the position of women in the world today. And I'll be investigating the concerns that are stopping the rest of the world's armies from allowing women to serve. In Canada, where women have served in these frontline positions for 20 years, I sat down with infantry captain Ashley Collette. And I started with the concern, can women handle this physically demanding job?
If you have one standard and the individuals that are trying out for your team meet that one standard, then the argument is essentially null and void. So some of the women that I've seen in the combat arms are more fit than most of the men, and vice versa.
Ashley was not what I'd expected. Athletic, yes, but also short, softly spoken, and petite, ultimately very stereotypically feminine. But I couldn't stop myself from wondering, if they got into trouble, could she really carry a 15-stone fellow soldier to safety, which is the example I kept reading about?
If that's the concern, then include that as a portion of your physical training test, and if the person that's doing the test can perform the act, then you have no concerns.
So could you do it?
Yes.
Did you have to lug a man anywhere? Did you have to do any of that heavy lifting?
That is a part of our test in Canada, and the test that we did before we deployed, you actually have to carry them, and now it's changed to a combat drag, and I perform that test every year, and I have done it in training scenarios, and I've done it in battle scenarios.
Presumably when you go through this process, people drop out. What is the main reason people drop out?
In my phase training, most of the people that dropped out left the course for an injury.
And
there was also a lot of individuals who failed the training. They couldn't perform a leadership role.
And in your training, how many were women?
I was the only woman.
So everybody you've just spoken about who failed or had to try again was a man?
That's correct.
Ashley is a well-known figure in Canada, having won the Medal of Military Valour, Canada's third highest military honour, for her exemplary leadership of an all-male platoon of 40 to 50 soldiers in Kandahar, Afghanistan. But I was intrigued to know how the men responded to her when she first arrived to take the command.
I think that in the beginning they were weary, but I don't think that that's necessarily attached to my gender. I think soldiers are weary of their commander regardless of their gender. They always want to feel out your style of leadership and how you're going to be capable of commanding them. After our deployment, some of the soldiers came to me and they actually said, you know, in the beginning we were weary of you, and now we would follow you anywhere.
And did you find it intimidating at all to have to try and get all of those people on board with you?
It was certainly a consideration for me, and in the beginning of my career, I think I found it more intimidating than I do now. I mean, I'm still aware that these sort of assumptions and expectations still exist, but I just don't care anymore what people are saying.
So when you were out there in Afghanistan, how many months was it?
It was 8 months.
It was 8 months. What was the fighting like?
It was a challenge, to say the least. So my platoon, specifically the spot that we were in the beginning, we came under direct fire from the enemy between 2 and 3 times a day for about 3 months. And also, we experienced multiple improvised explosive devices, multiple blasts, injuries to the platoon. Everybody was kind of always on a state of high readiness. So it's challenging physically and it's challenging mentally as well. But I was so proud of the way that they were as a team. Like, they really were a band of brothers that had supported each other and made it through absolute horrible circumstances coming out on top.
Interesting you say, you know, band of brothers. Do you see any reason why a band of brothers couldn't include a sister?
In my experience, there's no reason why a band of brothers cannot be a band of brothers and sisters. And in my experience, that was the case. I was truly treated as a member of the family and respected as such.
Do you think there's any reticence amongst any of the men you served with to let you come to harm over another man?
I don't think there was any difference in the way I was protected as their leader as the way my male peers were protected by their subordinates in a sister platoon.
Okay.
So in my experience, subordinates who respect their leader do tend to protect that leader, but it's not gender dependent.
How did going to Afghanistan affect you?
I think that it changed my outlook on life forever. You know, that was a permanent shift in my view on life and in the world and what happens in the world. But I think that has come out in a positive manner. I think I've grown from my experiences there.
But has it affected you knowing that you instructed men to kill others?
Yes, I have thought about it, I've considered it over time, but I was also very highly trained to do that job. I mean, I went through more than a total of 4 years of training just to be capable of doing that job.
Like the Canadian Army, the South African National Defence Force has had mixed gender infantry units for around 20 years, and Felicia Mchanwi was one of the first to join. Now a lieutenant colonel, she remembers arriving a few years back and shortly before an overseas deployment to take command of a 110-strong company. What was her biggest worry?
Rejection. I thought that I will get problems where you will find them having a problem being commanded by a female and where you have to work so hard to change their minds and them listening to your instructions, your commands and all those things. If I experienced that, it was really to a minimum.
Still, Felicia did find that problems arose from time to time.
It was not difficult to sort of fit in with them, but you do get individuals. That's the fact of the matter. I'm Xhosa and you work with Zulus, and you'll find out that there's this thing that you have to give this respect to a male Zulu, for example. So I am the commander, I cannot bow down to a subordinate. So you will find those small individuals where they will have a problem that, okay, this Xhosa woman coming to command us, a Zulu man, and she's a woman cannot tell us what to do and all that. But I made it straight to them that the fortunate part of it, I'm their commander, so they'll need to be strong about it. Then I tried to have a communication where I tried to, like, introduce myself to them, make myself known, and what is my style of commanding.
Another issue which often comes up when discussing women serving in infantry units is how the teams will bond if they aren't all living together. So at Camp Meaford in Canada, I asked Brenda and Ashley to show me around the pretty intimate living quarters to explain how it works in the Canadian Army.
Right, okay, so what have we got in here?
So then? These are the rooms.
So we've got, how many beds have we got in here? We've got
six beds.
And do you sleep mixed gender or do you sleep separate gender?
Yes. Mixed gender.
Okay, and so what's that like when you've been training or whatever and you stayed in rooms like this? Is it peculiar to sleep with lots of men or is it normal?
Now I would find it normal.
Yeah, me too.
And I never had a problem with it.
Me neither.
You never did?
No.
Okay.
You have your own bed space. You wear respectable clothing to bed. Like I always did anyway. I always wore pajamas. Yeah. And the boys,
what do the guys wear?
Usually they're boxers or whatnot.
So you're surrounded by men in your underpants wearing full pajamas?
Yes.
Okay, and so
but it seems normal with more time, right?
Yeah, and is it, you know, is it like the Waltons? Are you all saying goodnight to each other, or is there lots of jokes before you go to bed? Like, what's the atmosphere?
Yeah, there's banter. There's
lots of jokes, and like this is the space where the instructors aren't present. So this is the space where you can kind of go and make jokes. Seems like you're in a room with your siblings. That's what it feels like.
It really is like that. Yeah,
as if you had five brothers, and you know.
Okay. How neat do you have to be? Is it very...
These are personal lockers, but if you open the lockers, all the layouts will be the exact same. Everything in training is built to break down all that stuff that you have in the outside, right? So you all are the same. You all assimilate in the same way.
And do you think the Army has achieved that for women?
Oh, yeah.
I think so, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think some women would find it intimidating?
You definitely have to be modest with your... how you're going about that, right? So even when changing and stuff, I would change in my closet. I would change under the covers.
Can you physically fit?
I could fit in the closet, yeah. They're large enough that
so
I could fit.
So you'd actually physically get in and change in
there. I have a story for you that will help you understand how it can be funny sometimes.
Okay.
In the field, I was living in a tent on my face training, and I was the only female in my face training. Mm-hmm. So I would pull my sleeping bag over to change under my sleeping bag, right? And normally this was a successful endeavor, and everything worked out just fine, and I would come out
time
wearing a different uniform. But I don't know what happened in this one attempt to change under my sleeping bag. But the sleeping bag fell, and here I am standing in my bright blue underwear and bra, and I'm like, oh, God. But I had been with these individuals for up to 2 years at this point training, right? So I am like their sister. They treat me like their family. Somebody from the group takes this big yelling voice and said, oh, Ashley, everybody look at Ashley. You know, their sleeping bag fell off. Everybody has a good laugh. I laugh with them because what can you do? Pull the sleeping bag back up and change my clothes and everyone carries on because you have way bigger things to worry about.
You guys obviously seem like you've got a great sense of humour, and you've obviously, I'm sure, developed that over the years. But are there any circumstances where it's crossed a line, or where you just feel it could be perceived as sexist?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's times, and a lot of the time you don't say anything, and you just let it slide, and usually by your reaction they know what they've said something wrong or inappropriate.
There's been times where I have stood up for myself or someone else who has been a minority in the group that it has just totally been offside or inappropriate. Like, you're allowed to stand up for yourself.
Absolutely.
You know?
Could you give an example?
I've found, actually, that long before I've had to defend myself, there's been two or three people in the group that have defended me. When I was overseas, a couple times... outside units would come to work with the platoon and they would make comments on my physical appearance as their commander. And soldiers from my platoon would actually look at those attachment soldiers and say, that's really irrelevant in this scenario. Keep your comments to yourself. That's our platoon commander.
Do you think the men you've served with have changed sometimes the way they speak and what they do because you're there with them as a woman?
Yes. In Afghanistan, we had a medic attached to us, and she would talk about banter with the boys and try to fit in with them and talk about dirty things that I wouldn't necessarily talk about. And one of my soldiers asked her, he said, why do you talk that way? And she's like, well, why not? You guys all do. And he said, no, we don't. We don't talk that way. And she goes, well, I can. And he's like, yeah, you can. And she said, why don't you talk that way? Why don't you banter? Why don't you? And they said, because Brenda doesn't. And that's how we are. I'm not going to talk about my wife or my girlfriend.
Great. Oh, it's a good time in the bedroom. Thanks.
And I want to see you get in the closet.
Come out in a different uniform.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett from the BBC.
Hi, I'm Colonel Jenny Carignan. Nice to meet you.
While I was in Canada, I went to see Colonel Jenny Carignan, one of the Canadian Army's most senior women and now the commander of the Royal Military College Saint-Jean. I started by asking her whether having women on the front line has improved the combat capability of the Canadian Army.
I think so. I think the army I see today is very, very different from the army that I saw in the 1990s. The leaders that we have today are much better than the leaders that I encountered in the 90s.
Why?
Because there's a big cultural change. We went through a lot of scandals in the 1990s, harassment, hazing, alcohol, and on top of that, you had the women arriving in the combat arms units. So the arrival of women itself is not going to create change because, you know, if you just absorb them as part of the organization, women just become like everybody else. Once you change that culture, that's when you start to gather dividend from the overall thing. So a lot of changes started to operate and people were ordered basically to make the changes.
By the government?
By the government, exactly.
So it was the government that, would you say, forced through the way of getting rid of that macho culture?
It depends what we mean by macho. And is there anything wrong with that? What I'm talking about is mutual respect for everybody's strengths and weaknesses. That's all it is about, folks. There's nothing complicated about that. So anything that has to do with bullying and if people are disrespectful between each other, you take these troops out on operations and they will be disrespectful to the local population that they're supposed to be protecting as well.
Putting women, though, in that position, I mean, one of the arguments that's still hanging around in Britain is that the cohesion between men and women on the front line isn't the same as men and men looking after each other. I mean, what's your experience of that?
Cohesion and morale in a unit is a leadership issue. It has nothing to do with the gender of your folks composing your unit.
If a country hasn't done it yet, like Britain, what should they expect? And what could you have done differently?
There was a lot of overreaction at the beginning, and in terms of accommodation in the field, we've got to separate people and all of that. But after a while, it was just not manageable. You just can't operate like that, and now we just throw everybody in the same tent.
So you would advise Britain not to put their teams in different accommodation?
Yes, because it's about the team. So you have to develop a cohesive and functional team, and the way you do that, you have to exercise typical good army ways of doing things on how we build teams and how we get people to work together.
So training and improved leadership capability are seen as the solution to many problems, including sexual harassment. In South Africa, there is a similar strong emphasis on pre-deployment training, as Felicia explains.
Before we even operate in an area, we get lectures about sexual exploitation and sexual harassment that is now both within the Defence Force and towards the local community. So I think that helps a lot.
Felicia and her company received this training in 2008, just before they were deployed for peacekeeping duties to the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. Once in the country, Felicia soon found herself having to make contact with leaders of the various armed factions. How did they react when they found out that their local military commander was a woman?
They accepted me, let me put it like that, in a way that I thought they would be having questions as to a female, because I was the first female company commander to be deployed in DRC. I requested even to meet their leader, that is now Laurent Gunda, of which it happened. I managed to have a chat with him. He told me his own views about what they want. And I told him my views of what I want, because I hear what his point of view is, but he needs to understand my view as well.
When Felicia deployed to the DRC, being the first female company commander wasn't the only thing which set her apart. She is also a mother and had to leave her children behind.
When I had to leave them, I had to first sit down with them and explain to them that mommy is now leaving. I had to leave them with my husband, who is also infantry, and who's also at times having to go and attend his own courses outside infantry school. But due to the support system that was strong, it didn't affect my kids so much, because my parents are also staying in Otwaren. So when my husband had to leave, then the kids will then remain with my parents. So at times you miss home so much, you tell yourself, God, can this period finish? But then you remember again, why are you there?
Brenda, the sergeant in the Canadian Army, has an even more extraordinary story from when she was on a grueling tour of combat in Afghanistan. She was serving there at the same time as her spouse, Rick.
When I found out I was pregnant, the medic was my girlfriend, and she told me I was pregnant. And I remember the physician's assistant, warrant officer, was like, well, what are you going to tell him? Are you going to tell him? But he acted like I was 16 and that I was going to give him such tragic news, right? And I was like, of course I'm going to have to tell him. He's like, well, you can't tell him. He's in combat. I was like, we're in combat right now. Of course I need to tell him. He wants to know. So, yeah, it was kind of amusing. And I remember the medic turning to him and saying, what are you talking about? Of course, it's her spouse.
And would you still be prepared to go to Afghanistan or go to battle now you're a mom?
Yes, I am still willing to go, and I'm still willing to, of course I am. It's my job, it's my duty, right, to go. Thankfully, the Army has said that they will no longer send spouses together on a tour, especially if you have children. They used to. Rick and I have been on 3 deployments together.
But not since you had a child?
Not since we've had a child, no.
Would you find it more difficult? I know you haven't been since mm-hmm. you've become a mum, but would you find it more difficult, do you think, to go to the front line now you're a mum?
For me, I don't think that it makes any difference. It'd be harder to leave. Obviously, you want to see your children. You don't want to leave your children for that long a period of time, but I don't think the choice is different.
Issues like these and how armies address them are becoming increasingly pressing as more countries allow women to serve. In the DRC, Felicia served alongside women in the Kenyan army, while Nigeria and Eritrea also allow women to serve on the front line. Australia and New Zealand do too, as does China, and the United States will soon join them. In Europe, most countries, from the Netherlands and Norway to Spain and Slovenia, already allow women to serve in frontline roles. And in 2017, the Brazilian army will become the latest to change its rules. The decision there was taken last year when the newly elected President Dilma Rousseff decided that the Brazilian armed forces did not sufficiently look like the country. She supported a law which will require the army to admit women, and Luis Kawaguchi from the BBC's Brazilian service explains how they are now getting ready to admit them to the front line.
The army accepted the law and is now studying ways to have women take combat roles. But officials do not yet know how to solve some problems that the law could generate. Officials are studying ways to match the physical tests to which the cadets are subjected. Today, exercise is lighter for women in Brazil. There are also doubts whether women will be able to carry heavy equipment when they have access to combat roles. Therefore, officials are considering the possibility to place women first in the areas of logistics and quartermaster. While the study phase goes slowly in the army, Dilma Rousseff's government wants to speed up the process. It has reached agreement with the UN to allow in the future that women combatants to participate in its peacekeeping missions.
It's amazing how these are the same arguments which have faced almost every army that's gone through this process. And perhaps the Brazilian army could learn from Canada and South Africa. These armies and the women serving in them are together finding ways of dealing with a huge range of issues, from physical fitness and unit cohesion to sleeping arrangements and childcare. But what does this trend say about women and our place in the world? Well, I really can't emphasise how horrible the Canadian training regime was that we watched. How much I wondered why anyone, male or female, would want to do this job. Although, thank goodness they do. So I suppose I was expecting that women, who serve in these most unforgiving of units, in the most unforgiving of environments, would have to sacrifice some of their femininity, for want of a better word. But they haven't. They're smart, capable and focused women, treating their frontline role with the same diligence and respect as any other job they would have in the army. They weren't trying to be men. They don't have to. Three of the women in this programme are mothers, something they don't stop being when they step out on the battlefield, any more than their brother soldiers stop being fathers. These women had simply applied for a job, passed the test, and earned their place. And perhaps, if the world's armies, with their rigid discipline and strict code of conduct, can get that right, it would be a lesson for the rest of society. But I did have one final question for Ashley, Captain Collette.
Do you think women being in charge on the front line changes the face of war in any way?
Well, I think in a literal sense it changes the face of war. And as we talked about before, I certainly think that opening the doors to a diverse population of people who you want to try out for the job will change the dynamic of the job in due time. But I think war is war.
Women on the Frontline was presented by me, Emma Barnett, and the producer was Giles Edwards. 100